Hello, good morning, everyone. You're in security, wartime anxiety, and the erosion of civil liberties. And this is the fourth floor, Capitol One. I'm Christina Limi from the Japanese American National Museum. And I just want to remind you to turn off your cell phones. There's no audio recordings or videotaping allowed. We are using audio streaming, and it will be on our website, www.janum.org, available after the program. And I'd like to introduce our moderator, Eric Muller. Give him a warm welcome.
Well, thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. It's wonderful to see so many people here this morning, particularly given that at this wonderful conference, there are so many outstanding panels that are all seeming to run simultaneously. So it's tough to make choices, and we really appreciate that you've come to join us this morning. I'm Eric Muller. It's nice to see a few familiar faces here in the audience, and it's actually really wonderful to have such a big group, because I know that we feel very strongly on a subject like this that it's as important to have discussion and debate and to hear your impressions and your experiences of what the world has been like these last 7 years as it is for us to talk about some of those issues. What I'd like to do is just offer a few thoughts, a couple of them personal and a couple of them historical, that help explain a little bit about what my interest in this subject of the erosion of civil liberties during wartime is all about. Maybe present a couple of issues that we might talk about as we move through this morning's session, and then interview our main our main speaker, who, as you'll hear in a couple of moments, is in a fantastic position to really give us not just historical perspective, but perspective right there from the front lines of the battle over civil liberties since 9/11. And then after a presentation from our main speaker, open things up for discussion, question and answer, and sharing of your own experiences, your own impressions about the world that we've lived in. I am an attorney by training, and I did practice law for about 7 years before becoming a law professor. 4.5 of those years, I was actually working in a federal prosecutor's office in Newark, New Jersey, where my boss was none other than Michael Chertoff, the director, I guess. Is that the official title? The director of the Homeland Security. I'm not czar. He's the Homeland Security Grand Poobah. So he was the U.S. attorney when I was there, and actually he replaced the person who hired me, which was Sam Alito, who's now on the Supreme Court. So it was a star-studded office, although from a side of the political aisle that was not precisely my own. So that was my real-world experience. But since moving into academia, I really have focused much more on the world of legal history than I have on the world, the current world, and have written principally about the eviction and incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. And so it's primarily through the lens of a legal historian that I have looked at the world these last 7 years. I've had the luxury of doing that because I am neither Arab American nor Muslim. And so I have at least that comfort of being able to look at things a little bit more historically, as they have not touched me directly in some of the brutal ways that I know that they have touched members of those communities. But there is also a personal piece of this for me, which I just wanted to take a moment to place things maybe even in a slightly larger context than just the world since 9/11 and just the world of the United States. And that is 70 years ago this November 9th, 70 years ago this November 9th, my father was roused from his bed at the age of 7 with Gestapo agents knocking on and then pushing their way through the front door It was the night that we have come to know as Kristallnacht, the Crystal Night, the pogrom against German and Austrian Jews in November of 1938. This was an event that was designed to terrorize an internal minority group, a minority group that was cast as an enemy of the German people, and a minority group that was cast as an unassimilable group, a group fundamentally different from, fundamentally dangerous to, racially dangerous to, the majority population in Germany. My grandfather was carted off to Buchenwald that night and incarcerated for a period of about 6 weeks. He was then released, and my family fortunately was able to flee Germany in early 1939 for the United States, eventually in 1941. But it's important to recognize that those events happened in a nation that had a rich legal tradition. You know, Germany had in Europe one of the most advanced systems and one of the most advanced systems of protection for civil liberties that the continent knew. And yet, in the space between 1933 and 1938, just 5 years, there was an erosion of those protections, a slow chipping away at the idea that this internal group, this internal enemy, was entitled to rights, was entitled to protections, so that when a young Jewish man shot and killed in early November of 38, shot and killed a consular official in Paris, that gave an excuse to the German government to launch a massive system, a massive pogrom against all people in Germany of the Jewish faith, regardless of whether they were citizens of Germany or citizens of some other state. So that was 70 years ago in Germany. 67 years ago this December, as many of you experienced, young children were awakened after December 7th, 1941, as FBI agents came sweeping through the Japanese communities of the West Coast, rousing and arresting thousands of now enemy aliens, taking them off to Justice Department internment camps. And then we know within just a few months that turned into quickly a wiping away of the line between non-citizens and citizens, so that all people of Japanese ancestry, everyone of this internal group that was now cast as a racial enemy, an unassimilable group, was swept away and carted off to Manzanar and Heart Mountain and so on, the places whose names we all know. Obviously, this was happening in a country with a very, very rich tradition of protection of civil liberties. And yet in 1944, the United States Supreme Court in Korematsu versus United States held over a divided vote, 6-3, that the exclusion, the racial exclusion of all people of Japanese ancestry from the West Coast was not a violation of those rich constitutional and legal traditions. And now 7 years ago, almost 7 years ago, just after September 11th, there were young children of Arab ancestry and Muslim faith who were roused from their beds as agents of the FBI and of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, fanned out through communities that were predominantly Arab and Muslim, and on pretexts of violations of visa requirements, technical sorts of things, arrested and jailed and detained people where the principal selection criterion was the simple fact of the country they were from or the religion they practiced. I wanted to mention that it was the Japanese American community that was, if not the first, certainly among the first to step forward and say, wait a minute, we recognize this scenario. We know how this works. And in fact, a bit over a year ago, in a case called Turkmen versus Ashcroft, a case that was filed in New York by the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, this was a case in which some of those people who were arrested just after 9/11 on the basis of ancestry and religion, and who were detained for much, much longer periods of time than would be necessary for ordinary immigration matters, and during that prolonged detention were physically abused by guards, were verbally abused by guards and other inmates, were denied the ability to practice their religion in places like the Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York City. These people filed a class action lawsuit against John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, against the guards at the jails and other government officials, alleging that the abuse that they suffered violated their constitutional rights, and also alleging that their detention for longer times than was necessary on the basis of their ancestry and their religion violated their constitutional rights. Well, that case was heard by a federal district judge in the Eastern District of New York, and the judge reached a kind of split decision. He said that the claims against the guards and the government officials that were based on allegations of abuse, physical abuse, verbal abuse, that those charges could stand and go to trial, but that the charges about detention, the charges about alleging violations of equal protection from singling out certain non-citizens on the basis of their ancestry and then detaining them for longer times than necessary, violated their equal protection rights, the judge dismissed those claims. And he said, you know what? These were non-citizens. And when it comes to non-citizens, there really is no equal protection clause that protects them from detention. It is permissible, said the judge, for government agents to single people out on the basis of their national origin and hold them for longer periods of time than they would hold others. A group of people whose names you will probably recognize, at least their last names, decided to file an amicus curiae brief in that case, a friend of the court brief in the United States Court of Appeals. Their names are Karen Korematsu, Jay Hirabayashi, and Holly Yasui. You probably recognize some of those last names. They're the children of Fred Korematsu, Gordon Hirabayashi, and Minoru Yasui. And their claim, and I was privileged to be able to draft and file this amicus curiae brief on their behalf, was, we've seen this before. We have seen this before. They argued in the brief, our grandparents, not Fred Korematsu and Gordon Hirabayashi and Minoru Yasui, but the Issei grandparents, were singled out for prolonged detention on the simple basis of the fact that they were non-citizens from Japan. And they argued in the 1980s, Congress announced that that was a mistake. Congress provided an apology and redress payments to the Issei, not just the Nisei, but the Issei, for the mistake of prolonged racial detention. That's what Turkmen versus Ashcroft is about. And so it was both an honor and also a very moving thing to be able to draw that connection between the experience of the Issei and the experience of Arab and Muslim non-citizens swept up in these post 9/11 raids. So there are all sorts of connections that I think we can draw. But I also want to suggest to you, before introducing our main speaker, that the subject of post 9/11 civil liberties is something of a mixed one. We have seen very difficult times and very, very troubling things from the administration. We have also seen certain kinds of things not happen. Happily, there has not, one might say at least yet, been a roundup of 120,000 people. There has not been the same degree of wiping away of the line between non-citizen and citizen. There has been some of it, but it has not disappeared completely in the way that it did 60 years ago. There have been troubling court decisions, but the Supreme Court now, 4 or 5 times in the Guantanamo cases, has told the government, has told the Bush administration, we will not disappear the way we disappeared 60 years ago in the Korematsu case. We will let you, yes, we will let you innovate in your efforts at counterterrorism, but we will not vanish completely. We will continue to try to hold executive conduct to some standards of constitutional accountability in a number of stunning, I would say stunning, at least partial defeats for the Bush administration. So we have not seen in that sense the Supreme Court being as craven and as cowed by claims of executive power as they were 60 years ago. So it's something of a mixed story, and one that I think requires us to think carefully and critically about where we are, what we've seen for the last 7 years, and God forbid, should there be another attack like the 9/11 attack, whether we are in a position to stand up and make sure that there is no further erosion of civil liberties. So, having presented those initial thoughts, I want to turn things over for a while to Noel Saleh, who is in a position like very few people, I think, in the United States to talk with us about what that world since 9/11 has been like on the front lines. He is the immediate past president of the Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services, or ACCESS, and he has been on their executive committee for 20 years, since 1988. He's been a lawyer for 30 years, specializing in immigration law and civil liberties litigation. After September 11th, obviously seeing the looming crisis, he took a sabbatical from private practice to join the staff of the Michigan ACLU. And there he spearheaded their Safe and Free Civil Liberties Under Assault Post 9/11 project, which has challenged provisions of the USA Patriot Act and other actions threatening core American and constitutional values. He held that position for 3 years and then returned to private practice in November of 2006. In addition to this work for ACCESS, he serves on a number of other boards, including the National Immigration Forum, the Rights Working Group, the Executive Board of the Fair Housing Center of Metropolitan Detroit, and was a member of the Michigan Advisory Committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. So please join me in welcoming Noel, and let's hear some interesting thoughts.
Thank you, Eric, and thank you all for showing up today and spending your holiday weekend at this conference. It's really a tribute to you and your dedication to making certain that that which happened to your ancestors and to you in December of 41 and February of 42 and thereafter does not reoccur in American history in the future. As Eric indicated, I hold a number of different roles, and so I've had an opportunity to speak in a variety of different settings. And lest I be accused of pandering to the audience that I'm here with today, I need to make it clear that over the past 5-6 years since I've been making presentations, I always start my presentation with this quote: "The lessons learned must remain as a grave reminder of what we must not allow to happen again to any group." And that's a quote from Senator Daniel Inouye on the passage of the 1988 Japanese American Civil Liberties Act. And it is so appropriate for any group that I'm making a presentation to, because this is truly the lesson that the American society must learn. And I've always commented that this comment was very prescient by Senator Inouye, but in many ways it's still seemingly unlearned. Immediately following the tragic attack on September 11th, shortly thereafter, the President of the United States, George Bush, was addressing the Congress and the nation, and one of the first statements he made was, "No one should be singled out for unfair treatment or unkind words because of their ethnic background or their religious faith." And while the Arab and Muslim community was heartened to hear these words very early on, this was clearly unlike the experience of Japanese Americans in December of 41. What we soon learned was that while words are important, it's actions and deeds that really are the measure of how the country was going to respond. And the immediate response, Eric has actually already alluded to, the immediate response was a roundup of somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 individuals, Arab and Muslim individuals, non-citizens. So this was a huge break from the past. It was not lawful permanent residents, it was not U.S. citizens, they were all in a non-immigrant status, but nonetheless they were arrested and detained without any probable cause. This was just a list that was distributed by the Attorney General. You arrest these people, and the conditions in which they were held were clearly violative of what we understand as being our core civil liberties and rights in this country. And contrary to what the court said in the Turkmen case, you know, persons present in this country are entitled to the protection of the Bill of Rights and equal protection, and even according to the Justice Department Office of Inspector General, there were substantial violations of individual rights and liberties in this class of individuals that were arrested and detained. They were under 24-hour lockdown. They were denied any meaningful opportunity to contact their families and or legal representation. They were said, yes, you have the right to contact an attorney. We all understand that, right? Well, what it meant in practice, according to the Inspector General's report, was they were given a telephone and a phone book and one phone call. And so if they got a busy signal, if they got an attorney who couldn't speak their language, if they got an attorney who said, I'm not at all interested, that was their meaningful right to have contact with an attorney. And again, as Eric has indicated, they were housed in correctional facilities, not necessarily federal correctional facilities, and the guards were physically and verbally abusive to them. While it was not an official policy of the government that this is the way that these detainees would be treated, it was tacitly accepted and understood, and nobody was punished Nobody was prosecuted. Nobody lost their job as a result of these documented violations of their rights. So we look at the words. We're not doing this officially. We look at the actions, and it's tacitly allowed and accepted. And the government response continued in the same fashion. The next item that was closed deportation hearings at the whim of the Attorney General. If the Attorney General, quote unquote, designated an individual as of special interest, then deportation hearings were closed. And it was, what did it matter, right? These are not U.S. citizens. They don't have rights. We can close immigration hearings. The public can't have the right to see them. And the whole concept of our core values is that we have a transparent society. And one of the core principles of having a transparent society is being able to observe what is being done in our name, what your government is doing in our name. And one of the best ways to do that is there was this long tradition of open court hearings, including immigration hearings. That was wiped out with just the suggestion by the Attorney General. Now, we had litigation to challenge that. And in Michigan, we challenged it in a case called Rabih Haddad, who was the individual who had the closed hearing, and the Detroit newspaper group. Now, let me tell you how absurd this process of closed hearings took on. U.S. Congressman John Conyers, ranking member on the House Judiciary Committee at that time, and now the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, took a personal interest in the case of Rabih Haddad, because Rabih Haddad was a known political activist who worked towards bringing communities together. So John Conyers showed up at that hearing. Not his legislative aide, not some representative from his office. John Conyers himself showed up at that hearing. And John Conyers was barred from going into that hearing. Now, I was the attorney for Rabih Haddad, so it was a little strange to me that I could walk into that hearing and John Conyers couldn't. But that was challenged. And in the case of Detroit Newspapers versus Ashcroft, we had a ruling from a federal district court judge who was appointed by the first George Bush presidency, Judge Nancy Edmonds. And she ruled that unequivocally, you can't hold the closed hearings. It's unacceptable. And the government, in fact, appealed that case. And that went to the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Sixth Circuit, where in that case, in an opinion authored by a Judge Damon Keith, and that's a name we need to know about because of other things that are going to come under discussion, Judge Keith ruled that democracy dies behind closed doors. Now, and we feel vindicated. Well, the problem with that is that in the New Jersey media case in the Second Circuit, a similar challenge was brought. And in that case, the Court of Appeals held that it was acceptable for the Attorney General to just on his own designate persons for closed hearings. And the great legal reasoning of the Court of Appeals in that case boiled down to loose lips sink ships. So you have these competing opinions of the Court of Appeals that never got resolved, in part because the government said that they were withdrawing from that position. We can go on with a list of activities that the government did, from the Attorney General drawing up a list of 5,000 Arabs and Muslims who they wanted questioning, and how that was done. And it differed in various parts of the country. In New York and in Los Angeles, government agents would pick them up without notice, pull them in for arresting. In other areas where there was a more sophisticated level of Arab and Muslim political organization in advance of 9/11, in Detroit, for example, we worked with the U.S. attorney where there were, in fact, call-in letters. So you had basically the velvet glove hiding the lead fist, but it was at least a step in the right direction. You had a program called NSEERS that exists today, National Security Entry Exit Registration System. You had a policy initiated of criminalization of aliens failing to file a change of address within 10 days of their change of address. It became a crime for that to happen. You had, of course, then the USA Patriot Act. And I'm not going to go into long detail on that, but it was just these series of rapid events. And what did that do for the American society? These series of activities and policies made a much stronger statement than the original statement made by President Bush. And I'm reminded at this time that what happened is something that then becomes, how does it affect us? How does it affect the Arab community is that these official actions, although primarily focused against non-permanent residents or U.S. citizens, translated into a very real effect on the larger Arab American society. Prior to 9/11, there were instances of employment discrimination based upon ethnicity, Arab ethnicity, or religion, but they were so minuscule that they were just in the other category. Immediately following 9/11, the EEOC received a 2,000% increase in the reports of employment discrimination claims, so substantial that they had to create a separate category for reporting these types of claims. And while that has gone down somewhat in the years following 9/11, it still is a statistically significant number of reporting employment discrimination claims. We're glad to see that the government has taken the position that the Justice Department will prosecute those persons who perform hate crimes. And so the government is saying, we won't accept it from individuals, but what happens is that the government's policies as it relates to Arabs and Muslims in effect encourages individuals who believe that they are being patriotic in the performance of their hate crimes. So that while some of the most outrageous hate crimes, the first hate crime following 9/11 was neither an Arab nor a Muslim, it was a Sikh. It was a Sikh gas station attendant who this patriotic American killed because he thought he was an Arab and or Muslim. And the number of those incidences that took place immediately following 9/11 still continue to this day. In Michigan, where I'm from, not less than 3 months ago, there was a gas station attendant who was, who was assaulted by a patron who came in with a tire iron, you know, trying to beat him and smash up the gas station that was run by this Arab family. Not a particularly bright individual. He did it across the street from a police department. That's where they got him. And he was arrested and prosecuted. But what happens in these situations is that these people become aberrational, but understandable, and it becomes acceptable. And why does it become acceptable? It becomes acceptable because we watch how our government treats persons of color in this country. So we've talked a lot about Guantanamo, and I don't want to go into that. But it's acceptable for indefinite detention. It's acceptable for the government to claim that these persons are enemy combatants and therefore have no rights, no right of habeas corpus. And as Eric indicated, that ultimately the Supreme Court has gotten around to upholding the constitutional values, but it's 7 years later. People have been in detention for 7 years attempting to challenge and discover what's their basis of being in detention. So we look at cases such as the president's usurpation of power under the NSA, the National Security Agency, where the president believes that he has the right to authorize warrantless wiretaps of U.S. citizens as long as one side of that conversation is coming from outside the United States. And he implemented a policy of warrantless wiretappings of including of U.S. citizens. Well, who do you think is being wiretapped? Do you think it's, well, so we filed a challenge to that action, and we had a long list of plaintiffs, attorneys who felt they were unable to represent their clients because they couldn't communicate with potential witnesses or family members for fear of being monitored. We had journalists who had constant contacts, and again, we filed a lawsuit in federal court. And again, a federal district court judge ruled that we do not have an imperial presidency that has the right to authorize warrantless wiretaps. That we have a system called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and that if we are going to be monitoring phone calls, at a minimum, we have to utilize the principles and the guidelines contained in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The government appealed that, and the Sixth Circuit unfortunately ruled that the plaintiffs didn't have standing. And the reason we didn't have standing is because we couldn't prove that we were the subjects of the warrantless wiretaps. And the reason we couldn't prove that we were the subjects of the warrantless wiretaps is because of a concept called state secret, where the government said, well, we can't either admit nor deny that you are or are not a subject of a warrantless wiretap, because to do so would jeopardize the State Secrets Act, and it would give indications to our enemy of how we're spying on them. So therefore, this is protected information. And the Court of Appeals said, yes, that's correct, that you can't force the government to say whether it's spying on you, or even if it's not spying on you. And since you can't force the government to say that, then you can't prove that you're being hurt by this act. So therefore, you have no standing to challenge it. And with that sort of tautological reasoning, the policy continued to exist. Now, like Eric, I'm an attorney. I've been practicing for a number of years. What I really realize in the practice of law is that very little times do you gather and achieve true success in litigation. The success in litigation is the bringing to the public arena of discussion principles that are affecting all of us and that need to be discussed, so that we as a citizenry can go to our elected officials and put pressure on them to make certain that these kinds of policies are not acceptable. So with the NSA litigation, for example, there was a great discussion in Congress about this warrantless wiretapping. And the president has indicated that he will no longer be doing that, and he will follow the prescriptions of FISA. But even when he made that concession, it was sort of like his signing letters on other pieces of litigation. It's like, as long as I feel it's convenient to do so. And how are our rights being affected in this? It's not surprising that we've talked about, it's not surprising that that immigrants are the first line where the government feels that they have the ability to challenge or take away or erode the concepts of our civil liberties, because we don't feel that it's affecting us. These aren't permanent residents. These aren't U.S. citizens. These are somehow less protected people. But the truth of the matter is that once these programs are implemented, then it in fact will become to affect us. One of the first persons designated an enemy combatant was a U.S. citizen by the name of Jose Padilla, who was returning to Chicago, where he was born, on a flight from Egypt, and he was arrested. And he was held as not, he was not charged with anything, he was held as an enemy combatant. And that case went all the way, and it was challenged by an attorney and by the Center for Constitutional Rights. It was challenged all the way to the point where it was getting ready for argument at the Supreme Court on the authority of the president to declare someone an enemy combatant, hold them in a military institution and not advise them of the charge, and not allow them to have contact with an attorney. And when it got to the point where the court was going to rule on whether he had the right to contact with the attorney, then they gave him the right to contact with the attorney. And then when it got to the point where that they had to have habeas petition so that he could challenge his detention, then he was switched from being an enemy combatant to now he was being charged with being a terrorist. Now, for the 5 years that Jose Padilla was being held as an enemy combatant, it was said that he was planning to do a dirty bomb in the United States, that he had been trained to be a dirty bomber. But when it ultimately was required to formally charge him criminally, there was not one allegation about being a dirty bomber. It was that he had trained in a camp that was related to Al-Qaeda. And not that he had actually plotted to do anything in the United States, but that he had participated in a training camp in Al-Qaeda. And not surprisingly, after he had been in the papers for 7 years, last summer a jury in fact convicted him for participating in a training camp in an Al-Qaeda related training camp. Now, whether he did or didn't, but it took him 6 years before he was charged with any crime. And during those 6 years, he was subjected to psychological abuse, to deprivation of rights, where there was testimony, although the federal judge didn't allow it as a defense, but there was testimony to state that his mental state at the time that he went to trial was close to that of not being able to actually represent himself or to communicate meaningfully with his attorneys. So these are actions that were being done in our name, and these are actions that can ultimately have a spillover effect on the larger society. So I want to close by saying, how does it really affect us? Okay, so We have things like 2 days ago, the Justice Department indicates that they are now developing a new profile that is going to be based upon publicly available information on the internet, and it is now going to be okay to consider race, ethnicity, and religion as part of the profile for who's going to go on a terrorist lookout list, and who then would be authorized for investigation for terrorist activities. What does this translate to? I want to take a look at the Obama campaign. The Obama campaign, of which I am a very strong supporter and have been, okay? But the Republican tactics in response to the Obama campaign have been to, quote unquote, attempt to smear Senator Obama as a Muslim. Now that's the Republican tactics, but this is the senator's response, is to affirm that he's a Christian. But where is the outrage that in fact it can even be accepted to be a smear, to be accused of being a Muslim? In Detroit a few weeks ago, we had a huge rally for Senator Obama. And this is when Vice President Gore was there to announce his support for the Obama campaign, to make his endorsement. And there was an incident that occurred in Detroit where there were two young women who were wearing hijab, who were covered. And they were with other people who had been asked, we want you to be right behind the senator. We think you're good for the picture of the senator. They said, oh, fine, can our girl, you know, we have some friends here with us. Can they? Oh, sure, they can join you. Until they saw that they wore the hijab. And they said, no, 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 no. You're not the picture of the America that we want to present. Now, clearly, this is not the official policy of the Obama campaign. But what it is that these volunteers who are supporting an agent of change somehow knew, quote unquote, that it was not good for the campaign to have this image. And we're following that with even where you now have commentators such as Richard Cohen, a writer in the New York Times, and Leonard Pitts, an editorial writer in the Miami Herald, have both back to back written editorials stating that calling for Obama to visit a mosque, and it's not so much calling for Obama to visit a mosque as to expose the concept that it is now dangerous in American society to be too associated with Arabs and Muslims because these are now the new enemy. And if that's become acceptable on that level of our society, then we realize how it becomes acceptable on other levels of society. And that's where the danger lies. We have not had a repeat of concentration camps for Arab and Muslim Americans. And we thank the Japanese American community for that, because as noted this morning, immediately following September 11th, I know at Access, the Arab Community Center, we were getting phone calls from Irene and Nancy and saying, what can we do? We will not allow this to happen. But if there is another terrorist attack on America, we're not sanguine to believe and to feel that concentration camps or some new form of incarceration will not arise for those of us who will be designated as concern for American society. And that's the challenge that we're facing today. Thank you.
See, I told you we had the expert. We have about 25 minutes to open things up. I just want to echo one thing that particularly resonated with me in what Noel's just said, and that is you're listening to two lawyers talk up here, and what lawyers principally do is litigate things. That is to say, they turn to the courts to try to get the courts to step in and stop processes that have already been set in motion in Congress or by the president or in state legislatures or by police officers or by the FBI. That is to say, lawyers are principally reactive agents, and courts are a kind of ultimate backstop, right? They're the umpires. That's the role they're supposed to play. But I'm reminded, listening to Noel's powerful rendition of what's happened in the last 7 years, that if we are adopting a strategy of relying on lawyers, courts, and litigation to solve our civil liberties problems since 9/11, we're looking to the wrong bodies. We're looking to the wrong agents. Because we are reactive. We are looking to backstops. I agree very much that the central problem that we face right now, particularly as we wait to see whether another shoe of a terrorist attack is going to drop, the biggest problem we have is the nature of the discourse that's developing now in our political process that is, in a sense, softening up the people for further action in the event of another attack. I agree completely that the big problem that we're facing is not, the central problem is not whether or not it is the official policy of the Obama campaign to remove two Muslim women from the background of a photograph, but the underlying idea that to be Muslim or to be of Arab ancestry in the United States is dangerous. That's the problem. And to the extent that that idea is being allowed in this post 9/11 era to propagate and to reach a point where the simple accusation that Barack Obama's middle name is Hussein and therefore there's something disloyal and dangerous about that. The notion that that's an idea that can be allowed to sit there without angry challenge. And I can understand why Barack Obama may not want to angrily challenge that accusation. He's the candidate. But the idea that we are not angrily challenging the fact of the suggestion, that's the problem. And I think that the comments this morning really, really help us see that. So let's open things up. We've got, as I say, 20, 25 minutes, and we have a room full of people who also, like us, have been living in this society for the last 7 years. So what do you all think about what you've heard? Yes. Noel, do you want to address that? The question was, oh, that's right, we're supposed to repeat the question. The question is, who might it be that is benefiting in American society from this process of internally rendering suspicious this particular minority group?
I think that, you know, tragically, American history is replete with examples of having to find an enemy during times of crisis. And so whether that was the Japanese Americans during World War II or the Chinese Americans during the period of the Chinese Exclusion Act, whether it was African Americans under slavery, whether it was Native Americans when we're talking about manifest destiny, we've always seemed to have a need of somebody to be the other, and somebody, and that other is then used as a basis for whittling away or accomplishing things that couldn't otherwise be accomplished. We were supposed to be joined today by Polly Baca, a local Hispanic attorney who was ill, unfortunately. And I'm certain that if Polly was here, she would be telling you about the tremendous disparate response on the Mexican and Hispanic immigrant community. We heard references to that this morning during Secretary Peña's presentation about where are they building a wall along the Mexican border. It's not along the Canadian border. As somebody who practices immigration law along the northern border, I know a lot of Canadians that have been living and residing in the United States illegally, and they're never, but they're Canadians, and I shouldn't be so stereotypical, but they're white Canadians. So they, they're not perceived of as being the enemy. The immigration, now the USCIS and Customs and Border Protection, have implemented much more strict policies about arresting and detention. And the major victims of that have not really been Arab Americans. We've gotten some of it, but the major victims of that have really been the Hispanic community, to be quite candid with you. Who benefits from that? The increased security at international airports, where there is now a program, not just amongst Arabs and Muslims, but around international travelers who are now, emailing and blogging each other saying, don't bring your laptop with you because it's going to be downloaded when you enter the United States, and they're going to make a copy of your hard drive. It's these kinds of repressive policies that once you have this, you have to have somebody to blame. But then you can do these policies and they start falling over onto everybody else in the society. So, I mean, that's who's benefiting. I don't think it's, if it was a Sikh group that did the bombing, then it would be Sikhs. If it was, we have to have an enemy.
Let me just throw in at least one quick thought on that. I mean, one way that we might distinguish, at least slightly distinguish, partially distinguish, the situation with Japanese Americans 60 years ago and the world we're living in today is that it's quite clear from the historical scholarship that the principal impetus for the move to exclude Japanese Americans from the West Coast was one of the principal impetuses, if that's the plural, was economic. There were economic interests, powerful economic interests along the West Coast that had wanted to rid the West Coast of the successful Japanese enterprises, principally in farming. And this was therefore an opportunity for them. In a way, Pearl Harbor was kind of, in a perverse way, it was sort of their dream come true. It was an opportunity to bring to fruition what it was they had been working to accomplish for decades before that. It's a little bit less clear to me that there is such a focused and explicit economic desire here that is seeking to enhance this kind of program. But I agree very much with Noel that there is certainly in the United States, just as there is in all governments, there is an authoritarian tradition in the American government. The provisions of the USA Patriot Act, many of them, I mean, think about the timing of the USA Patriot Act. The Patriot Act was proposed a week, it was on September 18th, if I remember correctly, right? So the attack was on 9/11. Obviously, the Justice Department was in lockdown on September 11th and 12th. Somehow, within 5 days, the Justice Department managed to get a bill together and put it before Congress. Well, where do you think the provisions of the USA Patriot Act came from? It's not like they dreamed them up after September 11th. Much of what was in the USA Patriot Act were ideas that were probably in a filing cabinet in the Justice Department that was labeled politically unfeasible law enforcement tactics. In other words, these were not hatched after 9/11. Many of these surveillance changes, many of these changes in the cooperation between the FBI and the CIA, the sharing of data across lines that we had thought should not be crossed, were ideas that had either been floated in the past to Congress, but Congress had rejected, or that the Justice Department had never even dared to float because they just didn't think they could sell them. Now, after 9/11, with a frightened nation waiting for the next terrorist attack, all of a sudden, those provisions could not only see the light of day, but they could be passed overwhelmingly after no debate. So there is, I think, an answer to your question. There is, in these moments of crisis, always going to be a move to enhanced executive power, a move to the idea that we're facing this horrible new enemy and we need completely new tools. We need to completely rewrite the rules in order to deal with this new thing. The Padilla case shows us pretty well, actually, that, gosh, you know, they told us that there was no way that this dangerous person could possibly be handled in our civilian justice system. And then when push came to shove, that's exactly what they did, right? So I think that that's also part of what's going on. There's a kind of opportunism that arises at those moments. Other questions? Yes, Louis?
You want to read?
No, go ahead. Jump in there.
The question was...
the recap of the question, yeah.
The recap of the question is, would we comment on the recent Supreme Court case regarding the right of habeas corpus in the Guantanamo Bay? I think the significance of that decision is substantial. I think that it bodes well that our Supreme Court has recognized two things. One, the government had always argued that Guantanamo Bay is not part of the United States. I mean, that was the purpose for creating the camp at Guantanamo, is because it's on this tip of Cuba, and the administration could argue, at least they attempted to argue with a straight face, that that's not part of the United States, so therefore American courts didn't have a reach into Guantanamo Bay. Now, the previous case that dealt with Guantanamo Bay was the Hamdi case, but Hamdi was a U.S. citizen. And so he said, well, whether or not Guantanamo is American jurisdiction, here the Supreme Court said, when we have complete control over a piece of land under a long-term lease, that's American, and we're not going to deny access to American courts for that. That's a huge decision, at least from my point of view, in terms of being able to make certain that we're able to challenge an abuse of government power. And the fact that the Supreme Court then said that persons detained in Guantanamo have the right to challenge or at least find out by habeas corpus what's the basis for their detention. I mean, this is huge. I don't think that, I think as Eric indicated earlier, these types of rulings are a strong indication that at least the Supreme Court in 2008 is not going to be the Supreme Court of 1948 and allow this abuse of administrative power. So I think that's really the significance of it, is that it sends a clear message that there are limits on executive authority and administrative authority. And I think it also resonates, because I don't think even Supreme Court decisions are made without a litmus test of where the American public is. And I think it's a litmus test read by the Supreme Court that there are limits as to what is acceptable. and that they're starting to mark what those limits are.
I agree with everything that's been said, and we'll just add two very quick things. One of them is that, I mean, I think at the symbolic level, the decisions are of huge importance. In the way that Noel just suggested. Two worries, though. One of them is, remember that Korematsu was a 6-3 decision, okay? So the government won because it attracted 6 votes out of 9. Virtually all of the Guantanamo cases have been 5-4, and they have hung on the vote, as everything seems to these days, of a single justice, Justice Anthony Kennedy. He is, I would suggest to you, the most powerful person in the United States right now, Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. So a lot of this stuff hangs by the thread of a single justice. So it's easy to depict these as a rebuke, a sort of stunning rebuke of these claims of executive power. But they're very fragile because, you know, one additional or two additional changes in the personnel of the Supreme Court, and we would be looking at very different outcomes in all of these cases. The other thing to remember, though, too, is that, again, the court is just a backstop. So as important as it is that the Supreme Court said last week or 2 weeks ago that the government cannot create a law-free zone in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and that the habeas corpus writ has to run to that territory, that doesn't mean that the president and Congress could not together suspend the writ of habeas corpus, right? In other words, what the Supreme Court said was, in the absence of a valid suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, the president can't do this. The president can't put people at Guantanamo Bay and deprive them of the writ of habeas corpus. Well, if there were another attack, are we confident that Congress and the president together would not suspend the writ of habeas corpus for people in certain places or of certain backgrounds? I don't know. I just don't know. I hope not. I think they wouldn't, but I'm not certain. The other thing to remember about these decisions is that a president who is of a mind to evade these decisions still has ways of doing it. There is nothing in the wake of the Boumediene case from 2 weeks ago that would prevent a president from taking a big aircraft carrier and floating it on the open waters of the ocean outside the territorial limits of the United States and turning it into a floating Guantanamo Bay and depriving people there of the writ of habeas corpus. It's not at all clear that that would be impermissible. Because there are precedents that suggest that in places that are not U.S. territory at all, the way, you know, Guantanamo Bay is, it's under the sole control of the United States until its lease eventually expires. So there are ways around these decisions that a political process that was sufficiently scared could produce. So I agree that they're symbolically very important, but I also worry that they're very fragile. Yes, sir.
Strong on civil liberties and civil rights, you are determined to be weak on issues of national security. So I see neither Obama or McCain really pushing the envelope on either of these things. And I want to comment if that's a correct perception. That this whole issue of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, Patriot Act, etc., is not part of the national debate as we're looking at how we're looking through the eyes of the president's mind.
So the comment in question looks to our current presumptive political nominees and notes that neither of them really appears to be taking on some of these changes and some of these this creeping rise of executive power, the creeping marginalization of ethnic and minority groups. And so the question, I guess, is do we agree with the perception that there really isn't in the political process right now a forceful pushback against some of what we've seen for the last 7 years? No?
I think you're absolutely correct. I wish I could say no, but I think you're absolutely correct that is really the climate that our country is in terms of the political climate, where even with the establishment of a Democratic majority in the House and, there's not been significant challenges, and there has been tremendous accession to the demands of this administration in terms of expansion of its powers in the name of national security. And there's a vote coming up on Tuesday in the Senate that I'm very disappointed to say that I believe my candidate, Senator Obama, is going to vote in favor of it. And it has to do with the regulation of the NSA warrantless wiretap program and the immunization of telecommunication companies who voluntarily gave over information and are going to be protected from their violating their customers' rights. And that's why I go back to my earlier comment, is that litigation is a mechanism to promote public discussion, and politics is a mechanism to promote public discussion, that we really need to maintain a high level of vigilance and engagement. We can't allow that which you describe, that sort of, it's nobody's really talking about civil liberties issues in a positive way. We can't allow that climate to define ourselves, who we are politically, and we need to engage ourselves in whichever candidate we support and make certain that they then take a look at those civil liberties issues and that they become part of their campaign as well. If they don't feel, if Congress or your candidate doesn't feel that they have the support and the demand of the populace to take these positions, then they're going to take the safe ones. And it's our fault in that respect that we have not been as vocal as we needed to be to our candidates and to our elected representatives, saying this is unacceptable. This should not be done in our name. Because when they get that message, then that's their litmus test. And then hopefully we can hold them accountable for policies and that protect and recognize the tremendous threat to civil liberties that we're all facing.
We're about a minute away from the end of things, so I think probably the wiser thing to do will be for me to note on a note of optimism, a rare thing in a discussion of this kind of issue these days, that here we are, the 4th of July weekend, and look at the room full of people who are paying attention to these issues. That at least, I think, is a very encouraging and, dare I say, patriotic thing for us to be doing on the 4th of July weekend. So thank you, Noel, very much for your work and for your comments, and to all of you for being with us today.